If the past 6 or 7 months have shown us anything, it's that everything can change in an instant. Almost overnight, teachers and students have had to almost completely overhaul the way they do school together. Now, a couple of educators have put together workshops to give teachers a roadmap to creating the tools needed for this new world. Jill Randall is an assistant professor of mathematics, and Krista Rivera, an instructor of English at SUNY Adirondack in Queensbury, New York. They will soon be running the first in a series of 3 workshops. We spoke on a Zoom call about the project and if it was created because of the pandemic.
What this is a result of the Teach for the Future grant opportunity through some benefactors to the college, which provided us the opportunity to continue our education. It was a grant funded opportunity. And as a result, of what we did in our work through the summer, we both took classes together over the summer. These projects have kind of been developed through that. The plan of the program started pre-COVID, but we actually were accepted post-COVID and during COVID. So it did definitely mold what we've done, I think.
And yeah, so through that grant-funded education, the idea is we would go about sharing our experiences and our findings with other faculty members on campus, which is why we're running this workshop series. And we've titled it Helping Students Lead the Way, Instructional Tools for Promoting Self-Directed Learning. So we're really focused on translating what we learned over the summer into fostering agency for our students. And I think Jill would agree with this. We took it on because, you know, we're both lifelong learners and, you know, we expect that from our students. And so I think it's important to model that also as educators. So it was just a really great opportunity to try to stay in tune with contemporary pedagogical practices.
Absolutely. I would second that. I am in a little different situation than Krista is that this is my 17th year of teaching. So I do have an educational background in teaching, but I definitely, you know, it's changing every day. Education changes. So I really wanted to see what was new and exciting out there and kind of stretch outside my comfort zone, which is definitely what this opportunity did for me.
Now, the very first one is helping, again, you said helping self-directed learning, helping students get that. Well, actually, you're helping teachers help students get there. So how does that road go?
Well, I think it's a lot about building confidence. I think especially right now, Jill and I have discussed this, you know, there's this sense of lacking control, right? There's a lot of chaotic things going on. And so I think through self-direction, it will help our students feel like they can really take ownership over their learning. But first, we as educators have to feel like we're in control too of what we're teaching and getting it across the most effective way possible. But the big focus is, you know, 21st century skills, right? And a big skill that falls under that category is adaptability. And so I think that's something we're really striving to promote, you know, giving educators different tools that they can modify and apply as needed to their courses that best fit the content, their subject matter, but also the types of students that they're working with and what their needs are.
Jill, I was wondering in your situation where you have so much experience as a teacher, can you relate to other teachers, longtime educators, to try to adapt to this brave new world?
Yes, it's definitely been a challenge. I really try to take a student-centered approach to math. I teach math. Krista teaches English, as she said. And I really try to engage the learners and teach to their needs and help to meet them in the middle. And in this new environment, it's definitely a challenge. For me, going into these classes, there were many times I'd look at an assignment that we had to do, you know, to work through some of this and learn these skills. And I'm like, oh, I don't know if I could do this with math, but it really pushed me outside my comfort zone. And I was amazed at what I actually came up with and what we could actually do. So a lot of times we do what's comfortable. And although it works, you know, it's always good to think about what else we could do to make it even better. And this really helped me to get to that point and to really remind myself how rewarding learning is and how rewarding it can be to continue to learn and always strive to, you know, get to that next point.
And how did you end up writing a workshop to help other teachers convey that to their students?
Well, the workshops that we have planned really are the result of some of the projects and activities that we completed in our coursework, and really kind of processing through our different courses and how they overlapped, but putting them together into things that apply to what we're doing now, especially in the COVID world.
Yes, we primarily pulled ideas from a technology and education course, just because we felt it was extremely relevant to today's teaching conditions. And so I think when we designed the workshop series, we were keeping in mind accessibility of content, how manageable the content feels, from the student's perspective. Because if it doesn't seem manageable or feasible, we're not starting at the strongest place that we could. And also versatility, right? Just what are tools that educators can use to fit their needs? So I think that, that was a focus as well.
The grant you're working under, you called it It's Teach for the Future. And do you feel like you're on the ground floor of a new way of teaching?
I think I hate to say that it's the ground floor. I think that we're kind of always in the middle, working with what we already know and what's lying ahead. And just I think all educators really have to adjust almost daily, and you adjust to the needs of the individual students and the environment that you're working in, the content that you're working in, and so on. So I hate to say that we're at the ground level, but I do think that there's a lot of new things ahead.
I think that it's always our job as educators to be teaching towards the future, like always forward thinking, always recognizing that our students are going to end up being the leaders of tomorrow. But I think especially right now, there's a lot of uncertainty. And I think, the move to online teaching for many educators has just emphasized how important those 21st century skills really are, including self-directedness, including adaptability and curiosity, even just like desiring to learn more and be open and willing to explore new opportunities and new ways of doing things. So yeah, I would agree with what Jill was saying. I think it's always something we should be thinking about 21st century skills, but definitely it's sort of been intensified more recently.
So this first workshop is creating a video. How much of this is educational theory, and how much of this is don't be boring on video?
Well, I'll be honest, there is some of that, in an environment where our students are on screen time or have a lot of screen time all day, a video can just be one more thing. So you want to make sure that what you're doing is to the point and concise and so on. But it's also to really think about what your goal is. It's easy to just start recording yourself teaching a lesson and get distracted and not remember what your goal was. So one of the things that we're going to talk about is just really how to keep yourself on track, keep it to the point, and make sure you're really hitting those goals of the lesson.
Absolutely. One of the courses that I think we're keeping in mind a bit is a curriculum and evaluation course that we took. And so, kind of carrying out the ideas of intended learning outcomes and making sure you clearly define those and align those to your audience, right? You have to know your viewer. But I do think a lot of it is also, how do you make yourself presentable on camera? How do you make it engaging, something that your students are actually going to watch and get something out of? Because oftentimes, students might not feel the need to watch the video, or at least not the entire thing. So it's like, how do you make it worthwhile for everyone, especially if you're going to take the time to create it? So our focus is on, accessible design of the video itself, and the art of concision and precision, just kind of keeping things short and sweet and clean. But I think it's a blend of, educational theory and just the more, logistical things.
And imagine while producing a video like that, you would have to anticipate where students' questions might be.
Absolutely. That's one of the biggest things is even in an online class now or a synchronously taught online class, the students aren't as likely to speak up and ask their questions. So even when you're teaching in a day-to-day classroom in this environment, you really have to anticipate their questions. So that's one of the things when we started planning our instructional videos that we made and worked through the process with, was to really stop yourself and say, okay, where are the common mistakes that I've seen my students make? What can I do within this instructional video to address that? And even little things like giving them opportunity to work through a problem, like for me, for math, thinking ahead to say, okay, I'm gonna ask you to pause this video right now and do this problem, you know, so that they've thought about it before I go through the process. So it gives them time to process the information as well.
I think the beauty of the instructional video when it's well done is that you can really devote synchronous class time or in person, you know, traditional class time to diving into those complexities and really hashing out those questions. And so I think that flipped classroom approach is applicable here. But absolutely, I do think you have to be mindful of, you know, how you're delivering the instruction and what's kind of going through your students' minds, not just your head, because what makes sense to you might not necessarily make sense to them. So stepping into your students' shoes is important.
Still to come, our conversation with Jill Randall and Krista Rivera continues with a look at their second workshop. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guests today are Jill Randall, an assistant professor of mathematics, and Krista Rivera, an instructor of English at SUNY Adirondack in Queensbury, New York. We're talking about the Teach for the Future workshops they have designed for educators. Making an interesting educational video is one thing, but your next one is designing a PowerPoint. Okay, I've never seen an interesting PowerPoint in my life. How do you go about doing that?
So we were kind of amazed over the summer when we started working on this project in our class. It's called an interactive PowerPoint using kiosk mode. And so when you're under kiosk mode in PowerPoint, it basically unlocks the ability to create buttons, which sounds very basic, but through the creation of a button, you can sort of create game-like interfaces for your students. And they can progress through these slides in a non-linear fashion. So it's much more engaging. It's much more lively. You can create, like I said, games, little quizzes that are more just interactive in general. And so, yeah, I think it's a lot more fun than your typical PowerPoint that you just click through in a linear fashion, because it gives students a lot more liberty to choose the direction that they want to head in the PowerPoint. And there's, you know, auditory elements, visual elements going on. So it gets kind of complicated when you add enough buttons. So,
and then, of course, your final one is, I guess, the big one. You're creating a website. And I mean, there's a lot that goes in. That's kind of a culmination of all of it, isn't it?
Yes. And that's actually why that's the last one, is because you could use your instructional videos, you could use your PowerPoints within your instructional website. And again, it's kind of partially about the educational theory behind it, and part of it is just about the design of it, but really taking the time to think about what your goal is, what your expected outcomes are, giving the students the opportunity to not just see or read the content, but actually engage in it in some way. And then even if including in an evaluation at the end of that to really kind of bring it full circle.
The platform that we're using to run this workshop is Google Sites, which happens to be a very user-friendly interface. And so we're hoping that that makes it seem much more feasible and less intimidating, just because you can really make it what you want and you don't need a whole lot of knowledge about HTML and things like that to make a really effective instructional site. And we'll be talking about things like just using high quality images and just the little things that make a big difference as a student is navigating your website. And there are even ways to incorporate collaboration through the website. So even though it is something that the student will be doing on their own, it doesn't mean that they have to be in isolation and disconnected from the rest of their learning community. And self-assessment was another thing we considered as well, like how to incorporate little check-ins here and there so that students can monitor their own learning.
As you were designing these workshops, did you find that, well, one of you is an English teacher, one of you is a math teacher, it kind of works for both of us, or are there little, you know, nuances you have to do for different subjects?
It was very interesting to see how well it worked for both of us, but they are very different. If you look at my instructional website compared to Krista's, it's very different, but there's a lot of similarities in the structure and how we approached it. Same thing with a lot of the assignments that we completed through this program this summer. It's very interesting to see the commonalities, but then the differences. And again, for me, it really pushed me outside my comfort zone. So it was great.
Yeah, I think Jill and I make a good team in that sense, just because we do come from very different, you know, educational backgrounds as far as what our specialties are. You know, Jill brings the computational, logical, more concrete, but also abstract. I'm learning that as I look at Jill's projects. And I bring, you know, the English side, which is more linguistic and subjective and creative. So I think that makes for a really kind of cool combo, in the sense that when we do present these workshops, I think we're going to provide evidence that it doesn't really matter, you know, what you're teaching, you can translate this into some productive usage for your own classroom. So it's a wider audience that I think we can reach because we do have such different specialties.
Well, the first one is coming up the end of November. Do you have many people involved in this so far?
To be honest, I don't know. There is a sign up and they it's done through our professional development committee, and I have not reached out to find out how many people have signed up. So I don't know if I want to know.
To be determined.
Is this just for SUNY Adirondack, or is this for all SUNY? Is this for, can any teacher anywhere get involved in this?
It was put out to the public, so anybody that's interested in attending is able to attend because it is through the professional development committee.
You're doing this for other teachers. Have you tried these methods on your own students?
I have, especially the instructional video workshop. I have the interactive PowerPoint and kiosk and the instructional website from the courses, which I plan to adapt for next semester. But definitely instructional videos have come in handy this semester, just kind of making yourself appear more human on the screen. I think it's really important for them to see your face as an instructor. You know, it's helped me deliver content more effectively, like simple things like MLA format. So yeah.
Yeah, I would agree. The videos are something that I think many of us will use often. I actually just made a video yesterday for my class because I was attending a conference. So I used instructional videos to present the lesson. The interactive kiosk is something that I am going to be using in my class. We just haven't gotten to the content yet. So I'm definitely incorporating it. There's a lot of other little things that we picked up throughout our courses that I've implemented throughout the semester, including some of the active learning strategies that we talked about in the beginning of the semester with our coworkers. Just little things to change it up and keep the students engaged, which through this remote nature is very challenging. So there's been a lot of little new things that I've implemented. But also, I do want to just mention that, you know, although it seems very targeted towards the current environment and the fact that we're remote, all of these tools that we're providing can be used in a regular classroom when you're back in the classroom. It just changes up the modality a little bit. You could actually have the students bring their computers or be in a computer lab and they can use the instructional kiosk, you know, the interactive kiosk during class, and you could just be a facilitator. There's a lot of ways. This isn't just meant for, you know, delivering instruction online, but just as extra tools to change up modalities.
And I think for the traditional teaching, right, in person, I think this frees up time for other lessons and allows you to spend more time on those higher order thinking skills. So I think that is a beautiful translation.
Have either of you been in front of a class this year?
I think we both teach some of our courses or all of our courses synchronously. So I sit in this environment with my beautiful little background and teach like I well, I speak to them and try to interact with them the way I would in a classroom most of the time. It's not the same by any means, but I've not physically been in front of my students since March.
Jill Randall is an assistant professor of mathematics, and Krista Rivera is an instructor of English at SUNY Adirondack in Queensbury, New York. Their first workshop will be Monday, November 30th. The next two will be February and March 2021. For many children of military families, changing schools every few years is part of life. Starting fresh is often hard, and during the COVID-19 pandemic, the beginning of a new school year can be even more challenging. From Tampa, Carrie Sheridan reports for the American Homefront Project.
Moving around with her military family, Reagan McGarry changed schools a lot until a few years ago when she arrived at Plant High, a public school in Tampa where about 10% of kids are from military families. Now 16, she hasn't forgotten what it's like to be the new kid. She says trying to make friends now, with coronavirus precautions in place, means there's even more to worry about.
With masks, we're not like in close proximity and we're not doing group work at school, which is hard because I know, like, I met a lot of my friends because I sat next to them and they talked to me. And especially with lunches, since we have spaced out lunch tables, if you're a new kid and like someone invited you and there's not enough seats, like, where are you going to sit?
Plant High reopened in late August. About 75% of students attend in person. The rest take their classes online. McGarry runs a group called Student to Student, which helps new kids get acclimated, whether they're in the military or not.
We try and pair them with someone. Like, if they like chorus, we'll pair them with someone in their chorus class. Or if they like football, we'll have them talk to, like, the football coach. So stuff like that to make it easier because it really is hard.
When military families move, the parents often focus on schools and their extracurriculars as a way to help children settle into a new space. The coronavirus forced many families of school-age children to question whether it was safe to send their children to school in person or to choose remote learning. Chief Master Sergeant Timothy Bays moved with his family from F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming to MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa in July, at a time when coronavirus in Florida was spiking.
Cheyenne didn't have a lot of cases at the time, so leaving Wyoming and headed to Florida while watching the news, you know, we're a little nervous.
Their twin 12-year-old boys enrolled at Tinker K-8, a public school on base at MacDill. At Tinker, about 4 and 5 children are going to school in person. The rest chose remote e-learning. The boys' mom, Jennifer Bays, says they're glad to be in school, but the experience isn't the same.
They haven't really made friends as quickly as they normally do. They're still happy they're going to school, but they did say, I mean, it's different.
In some ways, coronavirus restrictions made the transition easier for the Bays family. Their teenage daughter, Kaylee, wanted to join the dance team at nearby Plant High. Since tryouts were postponed in the spring, she auditioned in August and made the team, a chance she might otherwise have missed. Her dad says she never missed a beat.
Our kids are far more resilient than I ever was at their age. And they impress me every time we move with the way they handle. Like Kaylee, this is her third high school.
Tinker K through 8 principal Rachel Walters offers a different take on military kids.
I don't know if they're necessarily more resilient, but they've just had more exposure to the number of times that they have to change.
After her school recently observed a moment of silence on the anniversary of the September 11th attacks, a boy came to her needing to talk.
That sparked something in one of the students who happened to be in third grade, and his dad would be deploying the next day. And I actually was the person that had the opportunity to talk with him because I was available. And so, you know, he had those fears that his dad was going to war and he just wants his dad to come home. And a lot of our students have those fears.
Walter says her school offers extra counseling to help military children navigate those big life transitions. I'm Carrie Sheridan in Tampa.
It's not just military families that have trouble juggling long-distance learning and long-distance friendships. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Students will be missing their friends this year. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Catherine Bagwell, professor of psychology, explores why friends are important for young learners.
Due to the global pandemic, schools have turned to remote learning, and social distancing means children and adolescents have spent little time with their friends for many months. Does this matter? Developmental psychologists would say, definitely. Friendship is often viewed as the quintessential relationship of childhood because friends spend significant amounts of time together, and friendships affect children's well-being in positive and sometimes negative ways. Friends are not just nice to have. Rather, they are developmentally fundamental. Within friendships, children develop and practice critical social skills they need in current and future relationships. They learn how to seek and to provide emotional support to others. They learn how to take another's perspective and to compromise and negotiate. They experience the thrill of making another person laugh. And they practice intimacy, sharing secrets and deeply caring for another person. My colleagues and I have found that young adults who had a close friend in childhood show better adjustment, including fewer depressive symptoms, than those who did not. Friendships can serve a protective function. In another study, my colleagues and I found that having a close friend protects vulnerable children, in this case those with depressive symptoms, from increasing peer victimization across a school year. The pandemic highlights the value children themselves place on their friendships. Adolescents, especially, are desperate to be back with their friends. Research supports this desire so they can continue doing the developmental work that friendships help them to do. Especially if the pandemic continues, we may need to explore COVID's limiting effects on friendships for years to come.
That was Catherine Bagwell of Oxford College at Emory University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.